Imagine moving to a new town and, discovering this secret local musician who just plays quietly in the corner of a neighborhood dive bar on the weekends.
Oh, yeah, the hidden gem.
Exactly. And they don't have publicists, they don't do stadium tours, they definitely don't care about going viral. But then you find out the same musician has somehow won 30 Grammy Awards.
Right, it makes no sense.
It's crazy. Three straight decades of uninterrupted, undeniable dominance, yet outside of their immediate radius, nobody even knows their name. So, welcome to a special editorial deep dive for The Edit, Destination Hudson Valley's editorial channel. Today, we are exploring a real-world version of that exact paradox.
Yeah, we are looking at a business landscape that honestly defies almost every modern expectation of what success is supposed to look like.
Right.
And to do this, we're pulling from decades of Hudson Valley Magazine archives, historical business case studies, and some localized records. Our mission today is to basically tear down the assumption that excellence requires relentless expansion, and to analyze the mechanics of a company that deliberately engineered a quiet empire just by refusing to scale.
And the subject of this deep dive is Main Course Catering and Marketplace, which is sitting quietly at 175 Main Street in New Paltz. The striking fact at the center of their story is that readers of Hudson Valley Magazine have voted them best caterer every single year since 1994.
30 years.
30 consecutive years. That is an unbroken 30-year winning streak in the food and hospitality industry, which is, I mean, it's a sector known for incredibly tight margins.
Yeah, fickle consumer trends, brutally high failure rates, all of it.
Right. So winning an award once or twice, you could maybe chalk that up to a clever marketing campaign or, temporarily catching the cultural zeitgeist.
Oh, absolutely. But sustaining that exact same
Ever.
level of community endorsement for three decades,
Yeah.
that is structural. It requires a foundational operating system that goes far, far beyond just having a talented chef.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's figure out how that operating system was built.
Yeah.
Because you don't achieve that kind of longevity by accident. We have to look at the founder, Bruce Kazan, and the specific set of skills he brought to the Hudson Valley back in 1990. My initial assumption, given how hyper-local Main Course is, was that the founder was probably just, I don't know, a passionate community member who decided to turn a hobby into a business. But his pedigree is actually rooted in Lincoln Center.
Which completely flips the narrative. I mean, Lincoln Center is the absolute apex of high stakes, high volume culinary execution in New York City.
Right.
The mechanics of operating in that environment are
Okay.
staggering. We're talking about elite galas with thousands of highly demanding guests, strict union regulations, and incredibly complex venue layouts.
And the timing has to be insane.
It's militaristic. If a ballet concludes at 10:00 p.m., the catering team cannot still be setting up stations at 9:55. The champagne must be circulating, and the hot appetizers must be perfectly temped at exactly 10:01 p.m.
Wow. So Kazan is forged in this environment where the margin for error is effectively zero.
Yes.
He learns how to move massive amounts of high-quality food through highly restrictive spaces. Then, in May of 1990, he leaves that high-octane world, comes to the Hudson Valley, and decides to launch his own catering company.
Right.
But the way he executes this launch is where I start to have a lot of questions. Because he begins running advertisements in the local newspaper to book catering gigs. He does this for a full year. But, and this is the wild part, he didn't actually have a physical commercial kitchen.
Yeah, he was fielding calls, designing menus, booking actual events entirely off the strength of the concept and his ability to execute.
With no kitchen.
Right, without a dedicated brick-and-mortar headquarters to his name.
I have to stop you there because, practically speaking, how does one cater a 200-person wedding without a commercial kitchen? Sounds like a logistical nightmare. Not to mention a massive health code violation waiting to happen. You can't prep that volume of food out of a residential refrigerator. If someone tried to sell a service like that today without the infrastructure to back it up, we would assume they were running a scam. Was this just sheer arrogance or absolute genius?
Well, what's fascinating here is that it looks risky on paper, but this is actually where that Lincoln Center training becomes the central mechanism of his success. Kazan wasn't prepping food in his living room.
Okay, good.
Yeah. He was utilizing what we would now recognize as early ghost kitchen logistics.
Oh, interesting.
He negotiated off-hour leases. So he would find local bakeries or restaurants that closed early, and he would rent their commercial space from midnight to 6 in the morning to do his heavy prep work.
Oh, wow. So he's essentially trading sleep for capital.
Exactly.
He's utilizing dormant community infrastructure instead of buying his own.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And he would also rely heavily on on-site prep. Because of Lincoln Center, he knew how to build a fully functioning satellite kitchen in a tent behind a wedding venue.
Right, right.
He'd used portable generators, rented cold storage trucks to maintain the strict cold chain logistics required for food safety. So he was executing complex supply chain management purely through hustle and operational knowledge.
The unit economics of that approach are fascinating. Because in the restaurant industry, the standard playbook is, you know, take out a massive loan, sign a 10-year commercial lease, buy hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of stoves and walk-in freezers.
Oh, yeah. Ventilation systems, all of it.
And then you open the doors and just pray that foot traffic materializes before the cash runs out.
Yeah. And overhead is the primary killer of food businesses.
Yeah.
But Kazan eliminated the initial overhead almost entirely.
Wow.
He generated revenue, tested his menus, and proved the market demand existed in New Paltz before he ever signed a lease for a permanent space.
Right.
By the time he actually invested in 175 Main Street, it wasn't a gamble based on theoretical projections. It was an infrastructure upgrade funded by proven existing cash flow.
That completely reframes the entire first year from a reckless gamble into a highly calculated stress test.
Yeah.
But surviving a year of logistical gymnastics and off-hour bakery rentals, I mean, that just gets you a building. It doesn't secure 3 decades of customer loyalty.
No, it doesn't.
Once he had the physical kitchen, the food itself had to fundamentally anchor the business. And here's where it gets really interesting. The culinary philosophy he developed for this, which he called BATH, B-A-T-H, feels almost shockingly understated for a chef with a Lincoln Center resume.
It really does. BATH stands for Better Alternative to Home. And you have to contextualize this against the broader culinary scene of the 1990s.
Right. The dawn of the celebrity chef era.
Exactly. The industry trend was heavily skewed toward towering architectural food, you know, foam, tweezers, highly intimidating, unpronounceable ingredients.
Yeah.
The prevailing wisdom was that chefs needed to present themselves as unapproachable artists.
They wanted the dining experience to feel like a spectacle you could never possibly replicate in your own kitchen. But Kazan actively distances himself from that pretension.
Yeah.
He essentially tells his clientele, I am not trying to intimidate you. I am providing a comforting, familiar meal, just executed at a slightly higher level than you have the time or energy for on a Tuesday night.
And beyond the psychological comfort it provides the consumer, the BATH philosophy radically alters the operational flow of the business.
How so?
Well, when you focus on avant-garde, highly technical menus, your ingredient waste is massive, and your specialized labor costs skyrocket. Because every plate requires 5 sets of hands just to assemble.
Oh, that makes sense.
So by focusing on elevated comfort, you know, familiar protein, seasonal vegetables, classic techniques, Kazan streamlined his inventory. He created a highly scalable, efficient production model that produced significantly less waste while still maintaining exceptional quality.
Which brings us directly to how he sourced those familiar ingredients. The archival material highlights that Main Course was building deep, localized relationships with Hudson Valley farms long before the term farm to table became this ubiquitous marketing phrase.
Yeah, in the early 90s, the dominant trend in food service supply chains was aggressive globalization. Distributors were prioritizing extreme consistency.
Right.
A chef in New York wanted a tomato to look exactly the same in December as it did in July, which meant buying produce engineered for long-distance transport rather than flavor.
Yikes.
Kazan rejected that globalized model entirely.
He just walked out his back door and started talking to the farmers in his immediate vicinity.
But from a business perspective, isn't that incredibly risky?
How do you mean?
Well, if you rely on a micro-supply chain of, say, 3 local farms, a bad week of weather could wipe out your entire menu. Why take that risk when the massive national distributors offer a safety net? Because it's about trading short-term convenience for long-term supply chain resilience and community trust. When Kazan started buying directly from local farms, he wasn't doing it to print a trendy logo on his menus.
Right. It wasn't a gimmick.
No. He was becoming a reliable, consistent economic partner for those agricultural workers. And in return, he received ingredients with vastly superior flavor profiles because the food didn't have to survive a 2-week journey in a refrigerated truck.
So the food tastes better, so the consumer trusts the caterer. The caterer buys consistently, so the farmer trusts the caterer. It creates a closed-loop ecosystem of trust.
And that ecosystem provides a massive competitive advantage. When a client hires Main Course, the product they are purchasing is genuinely unique. They are tasting the literal terroir of the Hudson Valley, curated by a team that understands the specific seasonal rhythms of their environment.
Yeah.
You cannot replicate that authenticity by ordering from a national catalog.
I see the appeal for the local community, absolutely. But here is where I struggle to reconcile this humble, localized approach with the reality of their high-end success. Because we know from the records that Main Course's client list isn't limited to neighborhood dinner parties. One of their most prestigious catering accounts is the historic Roosevelt Estate.
This raises an important question, right? Because serving a site like the Roosevelt Estate introduces an entirely new layer of complexity to the operation.
That's putting it mildly. You are dealing with American royalty, you are dealing with visiting dignitaries, immense historical prestige, and the kind of pressure that usually demands the flashiest, most famous catering names in the country.
Right.
So, how does a company whose entire philosophy is built around being a better alternative to home navigate the expectations of a client that requires absolute world-class luxury? Does a client of that magnitude tempt a business to abandon its quiet roots?
Well, it forces us to reevaluate what elite clientele actually consider to be luxury. The assumption is that high-end clients want the celebrity chef who brings an entourage and treats the event as a showcase for their own ego. But when you're dealing with legacy institutions, historic sites, or prominent families, the actual commodity they are paying for is invisibility.
Invisibility, meaning they want the food to be spectacular, they don't want to notice the machinery creating it.
Exactly. Think about the physical and logistical constraints of catering an event at a landmark like the Roosevelt Estate. You are operating inside or adjacent to American history.
Right, you can't exactly mess around.
No, you cannot simply roll a massive, greasy deep fryer into a historic library. You are heavily restricted by fire codes, preservation rules, security protocols. You might be forced to set up your prep kitchen in a temporary tent pitched on a gravel driveway 200 yards away from the actual dining room,
Wow.
all while battling the unpredictable Hudson Valley weather.
So the food has to be transported across the grounds without losing temperature. The staff has to maneuver around priceless artifacts without leaving a trace. And the entire operation has to appear completely effortless to the guests.
And this is where the synthesis of Kazan's entire career happens. He relies on that Lincoln Center background to map out the brutal logistics, timing the hot plates, managing the staff movements, building the satellite kitchens.
Right.
But he relies on his bath philosophy and his local roots to ensure the event isn't about him. He doesn't bring ego into the room. He provides world-class, high-pressure execution with extreme discretion.
The caterer who needs the spotlight is going to chafe under the restrictions of a historic estate. The caterer who is perfectly content operating a quiet shop in New Paltz is going to seamlessly adapt, execute flawlessly, and then quietly pack up and go home without needing to issue a press release.
Exactly. And the clients who require that level of sophisticated discretion, they notice, they talk to each other. That quiet reliability becomes the most powerful marketing tool in existence, far more effective than any billboard or viral social media campaign.
It's just a fascinating look at the mechanics of restraint. We've traced this company from the intense pressure cookers of New York City through a precarious year of renting bakery kitchens at midnight into the development of a humble culinary philosophy, the building of deep farm networks, and finally navigating the extreme demands of historic estates.
Yeah.
So, what does this all mean? When we pull all of these pieces together, what is the core structural lesson that we can extract from 30 years of continuous success?
I think the overarching three line of the main core story is the profound structural power of anti-scaling.
Anti-scaling, rejecting the instinct to grow just for the sake of growth.
Right. Bruce Kazan essentially ignored the standard modern business playbook. Once he perfected his model at 175 Main Street, the conventional wisdom would dictate that he should immediately try to franchise.
Oh.
He should have opened a main course in Brooklyn, one in Albany, one in Connecticut. He should have aggressively leveraged his awards to become a regional conglomerate.
But expanding like that fundamentally breaks the model we just analyzed. You can't maintain a micro supply chain of local farmers if you have to feed 50 locations.
Right.
You can't guarantee Lincoln Center level execution at historic estates if your staff is diluted across three states.
Every step toward massive scale is a step away from the tight control and localized trust that generated the success in the first place. So by choosing to master one specific location, he built a business infrastructure that is incredibly resilient.
It makes me think of the difference between a fast-growing invasive weed and an old oak tree.
Oh, I like that.
You know, the weed spreads horizontally across the surface with lightning speed, covering miles of ground in a single season. It looks incredibly successful, but its roots are only an inch deep. The moment a severe drought hits or a heavy storm rolls through, the weed is completely eradicated. The oak tree might take decades to grow, and its footprint is relatively small, but its root system plunges 50 feet deep into the bedrock.
And that structural depth is what allows it to weather the inevitable storms. In business terms, those storms are economic downturns, shifting consumer trends, or global supply chain collapses.
Yeah.
The companies that scale too fast, relying on thin margins and superficial reach, are the first to get wiped out. Main Course survived and thrived because their roots, their relationships with farmers, their reputation for discretion with institutions, their consistent delivery of comfort to their neighbors, were drilled straight into the bedrock of New Paltz.
30 years of readers actively voting for them is the ultimate proof that a deep root system yields the best fruit. It completely upends our cultural definition of ambition, really. We are conditioned to believe that true ambition means wanting to conquer the largest possible territory.
We really are.
But maybe the most potent form of ambition is the discipline to stay in one place, define exactly what you want to do, and simply out-execute everyone else at that specific task for a very long time.
It requires a rare level of professional maturity to recognize when a system is optimized and to actively choose perfection over expansion.
Which leaves us with a compelling question for you to mull over as we wrap up today's deep dive. We spend so much of our energy in this culture obsessed with relentless exponential growth. We are constantly told to scale up our careers, franchise our side hustles, and maximize our reach until everyone knows our name.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the legacy of Main Course Catering, what is your personal equivalent?
Yeah, like what is the specific craft, project, or role that you could commit to mastering quietly for the next 30 years?
If you stopped worrying about how to make it bigger and solely focused on how to make it better, where could you find absolute satisfaction in just being the finest in your own community? Because sometimes the most enduring legacy you can build is the one that refuses to shout.